Okay. How about I guess what he's up to and you tell me if I'm right or wrong? Kit shrugged wearily. There was no way she was going to guess it anyway.
He's trying to communicate with Livy's ghost, she said. The Thule story made me think of it. People who die, they exist in other forms, whether it's as ghosts or in other dimensions. We just can't reach them.
She blinked very quickly and looked down.
Yeah, Kit heard himself say, as if at an enormous distance. That's it. That's what he's been doing.
I don't know if it's a good idea, Drew looked unhappy.
If Livy's passed on, if she's in a good place, her spirit won't be here on Earth. I mean, they say ghosts can appear sometimes briefly for something important, or if they're called in the right way.
Kit thought of Robert Lightwood's peripatae at the side of his burning pyre. Something important.
I could try to talk to him, Drew said in a small voice. Remind him that he still has a sister.
Kit thought of the night Drew had come with them to Con Barnabas. Ty had seemed lighter, happy to have her there, even if he wouldn't admit it.
We're going tonight to...
No, better not tell her about Shade.
To get the last piece of what we need for the spell, he lied rapidly.
We're meeting down at the highway at 10. If you turn up there, you can threaten to tell on us unless we let you come with us.
Drew wrinkled up her nose. I have to be the bad guy?
Come on, said Kit. You get to boss us around. Don't tell me you won't enjoy it a little bit. She grinned.
Yeah, probably.
Okay, deal. I'll see you there. Kit turned to unlock the door and let himself out, then paused. Without looking at Drew, he said,
I've spent my whole life lying and tricking people. So why is it so hard for me to lie to this one person? To Ty?
Because he's your friend, said Drew. What other reason do you need? Opening the drawer that held his paints had meaning to Julian again. Each tube of paint carried its own promise, its own personality. Tyrian red, Prussian blue, cadmium orange, manganese violet. He returned to the fabric canvas he'd left blank the night before. He dumped the paint tubes he'd selected onto the tabletop. Titanium white, raw umber, Naples yellow. They were colors he'd always used to paint Emma's hair. The memory of her went through him like a knife. The way she'd looked in the doorway of her bedroom, her face white, eyelashes starred with tears. There was a horror in not being able to touch the person you loved, to kiss them or hold them, but an even worse horror in not being able to comfort them. Leaving Emma, even after she'd asked him to, it felt like wrenching himself apart. His emotions were all too new, too raw, too intense. He had always sought comfort in the studio, though he had found none the night before, when trying to paint it felt like trying to speak a foreign language he had never learned. But everything was different now. When he picked up the paintbrush, it felt like an extension of his arm. When he began to paint in long, bold strokes, he knew exactly the effect he wanted. As the images took shape, his mind quieted. The pain was still there, but he could bear it. He didn't know how long he'd been painting when the knock came on the door. It had been a long time since he'd been able to fall into a dizzy dream state of creating. Even in Thule, he'd had only a short time with the colored pencils. He placed the brushes he'd been using in a glass of water and went to see who it was. He half expected it to be Emma, half hoped it was Emma, but it wasn't. It was Ty. Ty had his hands in the front pockets of his white sweatshirt. His gaze flickered across Julian's face. Can I come in?
Sure.
Julian watched Ty as he ambled around the room, glancing at the paintings before coming to study Julian's new canvas. Ty had long wanted this room as an office or dark room, but Julian had always held on to it stubbornly. Not that he kept Ty out of it. When Ty was younger, experimentation with paints and paper had kept him distracted for hours. He never drew anything concrete, but he had an excellent sense of color. Not that Julian was biased.
All his paintings turned out as intense swirls of interleaving pigments, so bright and bold they seemed to jump off the paper. Ty was looking at Julian's canvas. "This is Livy's sword," he said. He didn't sound annoyed, more questioning, as if he weren't quite sure why Julian would be painting it. Julian's heart skipped a beat. "I was trying to think of what would best symbolize her." Ty touched the gold pendant at his throat. "This always makes me think of Livy." That's a good idea." Julian leaned against the center island. "Ty," he said, "I know I haven't been here for you since Livy died, but I'm here now." Ty had picked up an unused brush. He ran his fingers over the bristles, touching them with each fingertip as if lost in the sensation. Julian said nothing. He knew Ty was thinking. "It's not your fault," Ty said. "The Inquisitor sent you away." "Whether it was my fault or not, I was still gone," said Julian. "If you want to talk to me about anything now, I promise to listen." Ty looked up, his brief gray gaze like a light touch. "You've always been there for us, Jules. You did everything for us. You used to run the whole institute. It's my turn to be there for the rest of you," said Ty, and set the brush down. "I should go. I have to meet Kit." When he was gone, Julian sat down on a stool pulled up to a blank easel. He stared, unseeing, ahead of him, hearing Ty's voice echo in his mind. "You used to run the whole institute." He thought of Horace, of Horace's determination to have the whole Shadowhunter world see him speak with the Unseelie King. He hadn't understood why before. Without his emotions, he hadn't been able to understand Horace's reasons. Now he did, and he knew it was even more imperative than he had believed to stop him. He thought of Arthur's old office, of the hours he'd spent there at dawn, composing and answering letters, the weight of the Institute's seal in his hand. That seal was in Aline and Helen's office now. They'd taken what they could from Arthur's office to help them with their new job, but they hadn't known about the secret compartments in Arthur's desk, and Julian hadn't been here to tell them. "You used to run the whole Institute." In those compartments were careful lists he'd kept of names. Every important downworlder, every council member, every shadow hunter at every institute. He glanced at the window. He felt alive, energized. Not precisely happy, but buzzing with purpose. He would finish the artwork now. Later, when everyone was asleep, his real work would begin. Chapter 26. A Stir in the Air. Thunk, thunk, thunk. Emma spun and threw the balanced knives, one after the other, fast, overhead, overhead, sideways. They sliced through the air and jammed point first into the target painted on the wall, their handles trembling with kinetic force. She bent down and grabbed two more from the pile at her feet. She hadn't changed into training clothes, and she was sweating in her tank top and jeans, her loose hair plastered to the back of her neck. She didn't care. It was almost as though she'd returned to the time before she realized she was in love with Julian. A time when she'd been full of a rage and despair she'd attributed entirely to her parents' deaths. She flung the next two knives, blades sliding through her fingers, their flight smooth and tightly controlled. Thunk, thunk. She remembered the days when she'd thrown so many bow shuriken that she'd made her hands split and bleed. How much of that rage had been about her parents, because a lot of it had been, she knew, and how much of it had been about the fact that she'd kept the doors of her awareness tightly shut, never letting herself know what she wanted, what would make her truly happy. She picked up two more knives and positioned herself facing away from the target, breathing hard. It was impossible not to think about Julian. Now that the spell was off him, she felt a desperate desire to be with him, mixed with the bitterness of regret. Regret for past choices made, regret for wasted years. She and Julian had both been in denial, and look what it had cost them. If either of them had been able to acknowledge why they shouldn't be Parabatai, they wouldn't be facing separation from each other, or exile from everything they loved.
Love is powerful, and the more you're together and let yourself feel what you do, the stronger it'll be. You need to not touch each other, not speak to each other, try not to even think about each other. Thunk. A knife sailed over her shoulder. Thunk. Another. She turned to see the handles vibrating where they stuck out from the wall.
Nice throw.
Emma spun around. Mark was leaning against the doorway, his body like a long, lean spoke in the shadows. He was wearing his gear, and he looked tired. More than tired, he looked weary.
It had been a while since she'd spent time with Mark alone. It was neither of their faults. There had been the separation at Idris, then Ferry and Thule. But there was another piece to it, too, perhaps. There was an apprehensive sadness in Mark these days, as if he were constantly waiting to be told he'd lost something. It seemed deeper than what he had carried back with him from Ferry. She picked up another knife, held it out.
Do you want to turn?
Very much so. He came and took the knife from her. She stepped back a little while he took aim, sighting down the line of his arm toward the target.
Do you want to talk about what's going on with Christina? She said hesitantly. And Kieran?
He let the knife go. It sank into the wall beside one of Emma's.
No, he said.
I'm trying not to think about it, and I do not think discussing it will accomplish that goal.
Okay, Emma said. Do you want to just throw knives in a silent, angry bro way together?
He cracked a slight smile.
There are other things we could discuss than my love life, like your love life.
It was Emma's turn to grab a knife. She threw it hard, viciously, and it hit the wall hard enough to crack the wood.
That sounds like about as much fun as stabbing myself in the head.
I think mundanes discuss the weather when they have nothing else to talk about, said Mark. He had gone to lift a bow and quiver down from the wall. The bow was a delicate piece of workmanship, carved with filigreed runes.
We are not mundanes. Sometimes I wonder what we are, Emma said.
Considering I don't think the current powers that be in Alicante would like us to be Nephilim at all.
Mark drew back the bow and let an arrow fly.
It whipped through the air, plunging directly into the center of the target on the wall. Emma felt a twist of grim pride. People often underestimated how good a warrior Mark was.
It doesn't matter what they think, Mark said. Raziel made us shadow hunters, not the Clave.
Emma sighed.
What would you do if things were different? If you could do anything, be anything, if this was all over?
He looked at her thoughtfully. You always wanted to be Jace Herondale, he said, the greatest of all fighters.
But I would like to be more like Alec Lightwood. I would like to do something important for shadow hunters and downworlders, for I will always be part of each world.
I can't believe you remember I always wanted to be like Jace. That's so embarrassing. It was cute that you wanted to be such a fighter, especially when you were very small.
He smiled a real smile, one that lit up his face.
I remember you and Julian when you were 10, both of you with wooden swords, and me trying to teach you not to smack each other in the head with them.
Emma giggled.
I thought you were so old, 14.
He sobered.
I have been thinking that not everything that is strange is bad, he said. Since I came from Ferry the way I did, it closed the gap of years between me and Julian, and me and you. I have been able to be much better friends with both of you now, rather than an older sibling, and that has been a gift.
Mark, she began, and broke off, staring at the west-facing picture window. Something, someone, was walking up the road toward the Institute, a dark figure moving purposefully. She caught a flash of gold.
I have to go.
Emma grabbed the longsword and bolted out of the training room, leaving Mark staring after her. Energy was ping-ponging through her body. She took the stairs three at a time, burst out the front doors and crossed the grass just as the figure she'd seen reached the top of the road. The moon was bright, flooding the world with bright spears of illumination. Emma blinked away stars and gazed at Zara Dearborn stalking toward her across the grass. Zara was fully decked out in her Centaurian gear, Primi Ordine pin and all.
Her hair was tightly braided around her head, her brown eyes narrowed. In her hand was a golden sword that shone like the light of dawn. Cortana. A flash of gold. Emma had known, but still she stiffened all over. She whipped the longsword from its scabbard, though it felt like dead weight in her hand now that she was looking at her own beloved blade. Stop, she said. You aren't welcome here, Zara. Zara gave her a narrow little smile. She was gripping Cortana all wrong, which blinded Emma with rage. Wayland Smith had made that blade, and now Zara had it in her sticky, incompetent hand. Aren't you gonna ask about this? She asked, twirling the sword as if it were a toy. Emma swallowed bitter rage. I'm not going to ask you anything except to get off our property now. Really? Zara cooed. Your property? This is an institute, Emma. Clave property. I know you and the Blackthorns treat it like it's yours, but it isn't. And you won't be living here much longer. Emma tightened her grip on her longsword. What do you mean? You were sent a message, Zara said. Don't pretend you don't know about it. Most of the other institutes have shown up in Idris to prove their support. Not you guys, though. She twirled Cortana inexpertly. You haven't even replied to the summons. And the names in your registry were a joke. Did you think we were too stupid to get it? Yes, said Emma. Also, it seems like it took you a week to figure it out, at least. Who got it in the end, Manuel? Zara flushed angrily. You think it's cute, not taking anything seriously? Not taking the downworld or threat seriously? Samantha's dead. She hurled herself out the window of the Basilius because of your fairy friend. I already know what really happened, Emma said, with a feeling of intense sadness for Samantha. Kieran pulled Samantha out of the pool. He tried to help her. You can twist things and twist things, Zara, but you can't just make facts whatever you want them to be. You stood around and laughed when Samantha fell into that water. And the cruelty she saw, the terrible pain she'd caused, that was because of you and what you made her do, and that's the truth. Zara stared at her, her chest rising and falling rapidly. You don't deserve Cortana, Emma said. You don't deserve to have it in your hand.
I don't deserve it? Zara hissed.
You were given it because you were a Carstairs, that's all. I worked and worked to get respect, and people just gave it to you like you're special because your parents died in the Dark War. A lot of people died in the Dark War. You're not special at all. She took a step toward Emma, Cortana shaking in her grip.
Don't you get it? None of this is yours. Not the Institute, not this sword. Not the Blackthorns, who aren't your family. Not the reputation for being a great warrior. You didn't earn any of it.
How lucky for you that your reputation as a bigoted asshole is totally justified, said Emma. Zara's flush had faded. Her eyes glittered angrily.
You have 24 hours to come to Idris and swear loyalty to the cohort. If you are even 5 minutes late, you will be considered deserters, and I will strike down every deserter myself, starting with you.
Emma raised her sword. And strike me down now. Zara took a step backward.
I said you had 24 hours.
Rage sizzled through Emma's nerves.
And I said, strike me down now.
She jabbed the sword toward Zara. It caught the edge of Zara's cloak and sliced through it. You came here. You challenged me. You threatened my family.
Zara gaped. Emma suspected Zara had rarely ever had to engage in a fight that wasn't on her terms.
You're a liar, Zara, she said, advancing with her sword drawn.
Zara stumbled back, almost tripping over the grass. You've never accomplished anything. You've taken credit for what other people do and used it to prop yourself up. But people can see through you. You pick on those who have less power than you to make yourself look strong. You're a bully and a thief and a coward. Zara snarled, raising Cortana.
I am not a coward!
So fight me, Emma swung her sword. Zara barely got Cortana up in the air, and it clanged hard against Emma's blade, the awkward angle turning Zara's wrist back on itself. She yelped in pain, and Emma slammed Cortana again. It felt beyond wrong to be fighting against Cortana, as if the world had turned itself inside out. She ought to feel sympathy for Zara's pain, Emma thought, but she didn't. She felt only a savage anger as she drove the other girl panting and gasping back and back across the tufted grass until they were at the edge of the bluffs, until the sea was below them. Zara dug her heels in then and fought back, but when she raised Cortana and wheeled it through the air at Emma, the blade turned aside at the last moment, seeming to bend like a live thing in her hand. Zara shrieked, almost overbalancing. Emma kicked out and swept Zara's legs out from under her. Zara thumped to the ground, her body half dangling over the edge of the bluff. Emma stalked toward her, longsword in hand. A surge of power went through her like electricity coursing through a wire. She felt almost dizzy with it, as if she were rising above Zara to an immense height, looking down at her with the indifference of an avenging angel, a being of light gifted with power so great it had rendered them nearly inhuman.
I could bring my blade down and cut her in half. I could take Cortana back. She raised her longsword. She could see herself as if from the outside, a massive figure towering over Zara.
Their runes began to burn like fire, as if they had fire in their veins instead of blood. People said that the blades of those who fought them shattered in their hands. Black lines spread over their bodies, and they became monstrous. Physically monstrous.
Emma stumbled back, Diana's voice echoing in her head.
She stood without moving as Zara, gasping, scrambled back from the edge of the cliff, rolling onto her knees. Emma's vision of herself as an avenging angel was gone. In its place, a cool and reasonable voice whispered in the back of her head, unmistakably Julian's, telling her that Horace Dearborn surely knew where his daughter was, would know who was to blame when she was missing, that either hurting Zara or taking Cortana would bring the clave down on the Los Angeles Institute.
Get up, Emma said, her voice edged with contempt. Zara scrambled to her feet.
And get out of here.
Zara was panting, her face smeared with dirt.
You little pervert, she hissed,
all pretense at smirking gone.
My father told me about you and your parabatai. You're disgusting. I guess you want to be like Clary and Jace, huh? Wanting what's forbidden and nasty?
Emma rolled her eyes.
Zara, Clary and Jace weren't related.
Yeah, well, they thought they were, and that's the same,
Zara screamed, a tower of howling illogic.
And they're dead now. That's what'll happen to you and Julian. We'll leave your corpses on the battlefield, and the crows will pick out your eyes. I'll make sure of it.
What battlefield? Emma said quietly.
Zara blanched. Her mouth worked, spittle flecking her lips. At last, she raised Cortana between herself and Emma, as if she were warding off a vampire with a crucifix.
24 hours, she breathed. If you're not at the gates of Alicante then, there won't be a single one of you left alive.
She turned and stalked away. It took every ounce of Emma's self-control not to follow her. She forced herself to turn away from Zara, to turn back to the Institute. She raced across the lawn and up the stairs. By the time she reached the front door, her anger was turning into anticipation. She would need to talk to Julian. She had to tell him about Zara. She yanked the front door open, already picturing what Julian would say. He would tell her not to worry. He would have an idea about what they should do. He might even make her laugh.
There was a flare of sharp pain against her arm. Her rune. She gasped and flinched. She was in the entryway of the Institute. It was deserted, thank the angel. She pulled up the sleeve of her shirt. The parabatai rune there glowed on her upper arm like a brand, red against her skin. She sagged back against the wall. If even thinking of Julian did this, then how much time did they have left? How much time before she had to go to Magnus and have her runes stripped forever?
Slumped against the wall of the guard cell, Diego held his brother in his arms. Jaime had fallen asleep at some point during the night before. Or at least Diego assumed it was night. It was hard to tell, when there was no way to measure the passage of time except for meals, and those were served irregularly. There was only sleeping, eating, and trying to conserve Jaime's strength. Jaime breathed against him, low, irregular breaths. His eyes were closed. Some of Diego's earliest memories were of holding his brother. When he was 5 and Jaime was 3, he had carried him everywhere. He had been afraid that otherwise Jaime, toddling around on his short little legs, would miss out on all the things in the world Diego wanted him to see. Sometimes at the end of a long day, his baby brother would fall asleep in his arms, and Diego would carry him to bed and tuck him in. Diego had always taken care of his brother, and the helplessness he felt now filled him with rage and despair. For so long, he had thought of Jaime as a little boy, quick and mischievous. Even when he'd run off with the Eternidad, it seemed like another of his games, one where he was always slipping out of trouble and playing tricks. But in the past few days, as Jaime had grown weaker and refused to speak a word to Zara about the heirloom, Diego had seen the steel beneath his brother's playful attitude, his commitment to their family and to their cause. He kissed Jaime on the top of his head. His black hair was ragged, messy, and dirty. Diego didn't care. He was filthy himself.
Siempre estuve orgulloso de ti, he said.
I've always been proud of you, too,
Jaime murmured without opening his eyes. Diego gave a rough chuckle of relief.
You're awake.
Jaime didn't move. His brown cheeks were red with fever, his lips chapped and bleeding.
Yes, I'm awake. I'm going to hold this over you forever.
Forever. Most likely, neither of them had forever. Diego thought of the heirloom, its optimistic infinity symbol, looping over and over, promising a never-ending future. Eternidad. There was nothing to say. He stroked Jaime's hair in silence and listened to his brother breathe, every breath a struggle in and out like rough water through a broken dam. Diego's desperation for a steely was like a silent scream rising in the back of his throat. They both looked up as a familiar clanking sound announced the arrival of what Diego guessed was breakfast. Surely it had to be morning. He blinked at the dim light coming from the open door of the prison. A figure came closer to their cell. It was Anoush Joshi, carrying a tray. Diego looked at Anoush without speaking. He'd given up begging any of the guards for help. If they were monstrous enough to sit back and watch Jaime slowly die, then there was no point in asking them for anything. It only made Jaime feel worse. Anoush knelt down with the tray. He wore the livery of the council guard, his dark hair tangled, his eyes red-rimmed. He set the tray on the ground. Diego cleared his throat.
Jaime's too sick to eat that, he said. He needs fresh fruit, juice, anything with calories.
Anoush hesitated. For a moment, Diego felt a flicker of hope. But Anoush only pushed the tray slowly through the gap in the bottom of the door.
I think you'll want to eat this, he said.
He stood up and hurried away, closing the prison door behind him. Keeping Jaime cradled against him, Diego pulled the tray toward himself with one hand. A jolt of surprise went through him. Lying beside the usual bowls of gruel was a steely and a note. Diego seized them both with a shaking hand. The note read,
You were the only one who was kind to me at the Scholomans. I'm leaving Idris and the guards. I know there's a resistance out there. I'm going to find it. Take care of your brother.
What's that? Kit called.
He could see Ty coming down the dirt road toward the highway, a witchlight rune stone in his hand. It cast him into shadow, but the small crouched creature on his shoulder was still visible.
It's a wood rat, said Ty.
The witchlight blinked off as he joined Kit by the side of the highway. He was all in black, with the glimmer of Livy's pendant at the collar of his shirt.
Kit, who was not a fan of rats, eyed the animal on Ty's shoulder with some wariness. It didn't look like the usual sort of rat. It had rounded ears and a furry face and tail. It appeared to be nibbling on a shelled nut.
They're harmless, Ty said. They like to collect things for their nests, bottle caps and leaves and acorns. The wood rat finished its snack and looked at Ty expectantly. I don't have any more, he said, plucked the rat off his shoulder and set it down gently. It scampered off into the bushes by the roadside. So, Ty said, dusting off his hands, should we go over everything we have for the spell? Kit's stomach knotted. He was half wondering where Drew was, half anxious about what Shade was going to do. If the warlock planned to stop Ty, he was certainly waiting until the last minute. Sure, Kit said, pulling the list out of his pocket. Incense from the heart of a volcano. Got it at the shadow market, check. Chalk powdered from the bones of a murder victim. Same. Blood, hair, and bone of the person to be brought over, Kit said, a slight catch in his voice. Ty's pale face was like a half moon in the darkness. I have a lock of Livy's hair and one of her baby teeth. And the blood? Kit said, gritting his teeth. It seemed beyond grim to be talking about pieces of Livy, as if she'd been a doll, not a living, breathing person. Ty touched the pendant at his throat, still stained with rust. Blood. Kit forced a noise of recognition through his tight throat. And myrrh grown by fairies. A twig snapped. Both of them spun around, Ty's hand going to his waist. Kit, realizing, put a hand on Ty's arm a moment before Drusilla stepped out of the shadows. She held up her hands.
Whoa, it's just me.
What are you doing here?
Ty's voice crackled with anger.
I was looking out my window. I saw you walking down toward the highway. I wanted to make sure everything was okay.
Kit was impressed. Drew really was a good liar. Face open and honest, voice steady. His dad would have given her a gold star.
Why were you talking about fairies and myrrh and all that other stuff? She went on.
Are you doing a spell?
Ty looked a little sick. Guilt hit Kit with the force of a whip. Ty wasn't good at lying. He didn't do it well with surprise changes to plans he'd made.
Go back to the house, Drew, he said. Drew glared at him. I won't. You can't make me.
Kit wondered if any of this was still play-acting.
If you send me back, I'll tell everyone you're doing weird spell stuff with evil chalk, said Drew. Ty flushed with annoyance.
Kit pulled Ty toward him by his sleeve and whispered in his ear.
Better let her come with us. If we don't, and she tells, we could get caught or get Shade in trouble.
Ty started to shake his head.
But she can't. We'll make her wait outside the cave, Kit said.
He realized they would have to do that anyway. The first words Shade said would undermine the careful half-truths Kit had told Drew. Ty exhaled.
Fine.
Drew clapped her hands together.
Woohoo!
They crossed the highway together, and Drew took off her shoes when they reached the sand.
It was a soft night, the air tickling their skin, the ocean breathing in low, soft exhalations, rushing the tide up to the beach. Kit felt a sort of ache in the center of him at how beautiful it all was, mixed with bitterness at his father for never bringing him here. Another truth denied to him. His city was beautiful.
As were other things.
Ty kicked his way along the edge of the sand, his hands in his pockets. The wind lifted his hair, and the strands clung to his cheekbones like streaks of dark paint. He was purposely ignoring Drusilla, who was playing tag with the tide, running up and down the beach with her hair askew, the cuffs of her jeans wet with salt water. She looked over at Kit and winked, a conspiratorial wink that said,
We're helping Ty together.
Kit hoped that was true. His stomach was in painful knots by the time they made it to the cave entrance. Ty stopped at the dark hole in the stone bluff, shaking his head at his sister.
You can't come with us, he said.
Drew opened her mouth to protest, but Kit gave her a meaningful look.
It's better if you wait outside, he said,
enunciating each word clearly so she'd know he meant it. Drew flopped down on the sand, looking woebegone.
Okay, fine.
Ty ducked into the cave. Kit, after an apologetic look at Drew, was about to follow him when Ty emerged again, carrying an angry, gray ball of fluff. Drew's face broke into a smile.
Church!
He can keep you company, Ty said, and put the cat into his sister's lap. Drew looked at him with shining eyes, but Ty was already ducking back into the cave. Kit followed, but he couldn't help but wonder if Ty ever noticed how much Drew looked up to him. He couldn't help but think that if he had a little sibling who admired him, he would have spent all his time showing off. Ty was different, though. The moment they entered the tunnel, Kit could hear scratchy music, something like the sound of a song that hadn't downloaded properly. When they entered the main cave, they found Shade twirling slowly around the room to the sound of a mournful tune playing on a gramophone.
Non, rien de rien, Shade sang along. Je ne regrette rien, ni le bien, comme a fait, ni le mal.
Kit cleared his throat. Shade didn't seem the least embarrassed. He ceased his twirling, glared, and snapped his fingers. The music vanished.
I don't recall inviting you to come tonight, the warlock said. I might have been busy.
We sent a note, said Kit. Shade beetled his white brows at him and glanced down at the scratched wooden table. An empty vial sat on it, the kind they'd used to distribute the Lake Lynn water. Kit was pleased to see Shade had drunk the cure, though a little worried he might be hallucinating. Ty took an eager step forward.
We have everything. All the ingredients for the spell.
Shade's gaze flicked to Kit quickly and then away. He looked grim.
All of them?
Ty nodded. Incense, blood, and bone.
An object from another world.
We have that too,
said Kit as Ty drew a folded letter from his pocket.
It's from a place called Thule.
Shade stared at the letter, the color draining from his face, leaving it the sickly hue of lettuce.
Thule?
You know that world? Ty said.
Yes. Shade's voice was toneless. I know many other worlds. It is one of the worst.
Kit could see that Ty was puzzled. He hadn't expected Shade to react this way.
But we have everything, he said again. All the ingredients. You said you would give us a power source.
Yes, I did say that.
Shade sat down at the rickety wooden table.
But I won't.
Ty blinked disbelievingly.
But you said...
I know what I said, Shade snapped. I never intended you to find all the ingredients, you foolish child. I thought you would give up. You didn't.
He threw his arms into the air.
Don't you understand this would be the worst thing you could possibly do? That its effects would follow you all your life? Death is the end for a reason.
But you're immortal.
Ty's eyes were huge and pale gray, silver coins against his stark face.
I have a long life, but I won't live forever, said Shade. We all have the life that's been allotted to us. If you pull some Livy to you from where she belongs, you leave a hole in the universe to be filled by black sorrow and miserable grief. That's not something you can walk away from unscathed. Not now. Not ever.
So you lied to us, Ty said.
Shade stood up.
I did. I would again. I will never help you to do this thing. Do you understand me? I will spread the word. No warlock will help you. They will face my wrath if they do.
Ty's hands were working themselves into fists, his fingers scrabbling at his palms.
But, Livy...
Your sister is dead, said Shade. I understand your grief, Tiberius, but you cannot break the universe to get her back.
Ty turned and ran for the tunnel. Kit stared at Shade.
That was too brutal, he said. You didn't have to talk to him like that.
I did, Shade said.
He slumped back into his chair.
Go off to your friend. He needs you now.
and God knows I don't. Kit backed up and spun and ran, following Ty's witchlight. He spilled out onto the beach to find Ty already there, bent over and gasping for breath. Drew leapt to her feet, spilling a meowing church onto the ground.
What's happened? What's wrong?
Kit put his hand on Ty's back, between his shoulder blades.
He was a little startled to find Ty's back more solid and lightly muscled than he would have thought. He always thought of Ty as fragile, but he didn't feel fragile. He felt like iron hammered thin, flexible but unbreakable.
Kit remembered hearing somewhere that it was soothing to rub circles on someone's back, so he did that. Ty's breaths began to regulate.
It isn't going to work, Kit said, looking firmly at Drew over Ty's back. We aren't going to be able to see Livy's ghost.
I'm sorry, Drew whispered. I would have liked to have seen her too.
Ty straightened up. His eyes were wet. He rubbed them fiercely.
No, I'm sorry, Drew.
Kit and Drew exchanged a startled look. It hadn't occurred to Kit before that Ty might feel not just disappointed, but as if he had let the others down.
Don't be sorry, Drew said. Some things aren't possible.
She put her hand out a little shyly.
If you feel bad, I'll watch movies all night with you in the TV room. I can make cookies, too. That always helps.
There was a long pause. Ty reached out to take Drew's hand.
That would be nice.
Kit felt a wash of relief so enormous he almost staggered. Ty had remembered he had a sister. Surely that was something. He had expected much worse. A disappointment he couldn't calculate. A hurt so deep, nothing he could have said would touch it.
Come on, Drew tugged Ty's hand, and together they started back toward the Institute.
Kit followed, pausing as they began to scramble up the first of the rock walls that blocked the way across the beach. As Ty and Drew climbed, he looked back over his shoulder and saw Shade watching them from the darkness of his cave entrance. He shook his head at Kit once, before vanishing back into the shadows.
The wind was blowing from the desert. Christina and Mark sat near the statues Arthur Blackthorne had imported from England and placed among the cacti of the Santa Monica Mountains. The sand was still warm from the sunlight of the day and soft under Mark, like the deep pile of a carpet. In the wild hunt, he and Kieran would have found this a very fine bed.
I am worried, Christina said, that we hurt Kieran earlier today.
She was barefoot in the sand, wearing a short lace dress and gold earrings. Looking at her maid, Mark's heart hurt, so he glanced up at the statue of Virgil, his old friend of frustrated nights. Virgil stared back impassively, without advice.
His worries are my worries, too, said Mark. It is difficult to ease his fears when I cannot ease my own.
You don't have to ease other people's fears to share yours, Mark.
Christina was playing with her medallion, her long fingers caressing the etching of Raziel.
Mark wanted badly to kiss her. Instead, he dug his fingers into the sand.
I could say the same to you, he said. You have been tense as a bowstring all day. You are fearful, too.
She sighed and poked his leg lightly with her bare foot.
Fine, you tell me, and I'll tell you.
I have been worried about my sister, Mark said.
Christina looked puzzled.
That isn't what I thought you would say.
My sister was exiled because of a fairy blood, said Mark. You know the story, all of it.
You know it better than most.
He couldn't help it. He put his hand over hers in the sand.
All of my family has suffered because we have fairy parentage. Our loyalty has always been questioned. How much worse would it be for her and for Aline if I were with Kieran and he were the king of the Unseelie court? Sounds so strange to say, and so selfish.
It is not selfish.
They both looked up. Kieran stood in the space between two statues, pale as a statue himself. His hair was black raven wings in the darkness, which washed all the blue from its color.
You are worried about your family, said Kieran.
that is not selfish. It is what I learned from you and from Julian. To want to protect others more than you want your own happiness. He glanced sideways. Not that I wish to assume that being with me would bring you happiness. Mark was speechless, but Christina stretched out her arms. Gold bracelets shimmered against her brown skin as she beckoned to Kieran.
Come and sit with us.
Kieran was also barefoot, fairies often were. He prowled like a cat through the sand, his steps kicking up no dust, his movements silent as he sank to his knees opposite Christina and Mark.
It would make me happy, Mark said. But as you said, he took a handful of sand and let it sift through his fingers. There are other considerations.
I might not become king, said Kieran.
But you might, said Christina.
I too am afraid. I spoke to my mother today. Someone had said something nasty to her about me. That I was involved with fairies. That I was a dirty girl, besmirched by downworlders. You know I don't care what anyone says about me, she added hastily. And my mother could withstand it as well, but it is a bad time to be Rosales. Our history of friendship with fairies has already brought us trouble. Jaime and Diego are in jail. What if I bring further trouble on them?
Now I wish to tell you something selfish, Kieran said. I was afraid both of you regretted what happened last night, that you both regretted me.
Mark and Christina looked at each other. She shook her head, the wind lifting her dark hair.
There is no regret, said Mark. Only...
I know, Kieran said.
I knew it when Gwen came and told me I should be king. I knew what it would mean. Even what it would mean for me to be involved with the court at all, as it seems it must be. The Clave wants to control access to the courts. They always have. For two shadow hunters they do not control, who have the ear of the king, would be anathema to them.
But Kieran, Christina said.
I am not a fool, Kieran said. I know when something is impossible. His eyes were shields of metal, one tarnished, one new.
I've always been an unquiet soul. In my father's court, and then in the hunt. I raged and stormed inside my heart.
He bent his head.
I knew when I met Mark that I'd found the one person who gave my soul peace. I did not think I would find that in anyone else again. But I have. If I could just sit here quietly with both of you before this gathering storm, it would mean a great deal to me.
And to me, Christina said.
She held out her small hand and took one of Kieran's gently. He raised his head as Mark took the other, and Mark and Christina joined hands as well, completing the circle. None of them spoke. There was no need. It was enough to be together.
Emma still felt jittery when she walked into the kitchen in the morning, as if she'd drunk too many cups of the coffee she despised. The hammer beat of Diana's words and Thule echoed in her head. She hadn't gone to Julian last night to tell him about Zara, but had reluctantly woken up Helen and Aline to warn them instead. Then she'd headed back to the training room in hopes that kicking and punching and falling onto the hard mats on the floor would make her forget about the burning of her rune, about the parabatai of Thule, about the words of the queen. Later, when she'd fallen asleep, she dreamed about the parabatai rune in the silent city, and about blood on the hilt of Cortana, and a ruined city where monstrous giants stalked the horizon. She still felt uneasy, as if she were half-trapped in nightmares.
She was glad to see the kitchen was full of people. In fact, there were far too many to fit into the small eating area. Someone had had the brilliant idea of supplementing the existing table with an overturned weapons crate from the training room, and folding chairs had been dragged in from all over the house. She'd been worried the morning would be grim as everyone rushed around getting ready to invade Alicante. She couldn't help but feel resentful that she and Julian wouldn't be going. It was their fight, too. Besides, she needed the distraction. The last thing she wanted was to be left in the Institute with Julian and minimal supervision. but the assembled group seemed anything but grim. If not for the space where Livy should have been, the scene was almost perfect. Helen and Aline smiling at the kids over their coffee mugs. Mark between Kieran and Christina, as if Mark had never been torn away from his family in the first place. Jason Clary visiting, the way the family had never really been able to have casual visitors when Arthur was in charge. Kit being the missing piece they had never known Ty needed, stealing a potato from Ty's plate and making him smile. Diana radiating her steady calm, bringing a level head to the family prone to dramatics. Even Kieran, who seemed to make both Mark and Christina happier when he was around, had folded into the group at last. He was showing Tavi and Drew the joys of dunking strawberries in maple syrup. And Julian, of course, standing over the kitchen range, flipping pancakes with the ease of an expert. "One pancake at a time, Tavi," Helen was saying. "Yes, I know you can get three in your mouth, but that doesn't mean you should." Emma's eyes met Julian's. She saw the tension in his shoulders, his mouth, as he looked at her. "Be normal," she thought. "This is a happy, ordinary meal with family." "You made pancakes," she said, keeping her tone cheerful. "What brought that on?"
"Sometimes when you start a war, you want to make pancakes," Julian said, slipping two pancakes onto a plate and holding it out to Emma.
Jace choked on his toast.
"What did you say, Julian?"
Julian glanced up at the clock that hung over the kitchen range. He flicked off the gas burner and began to calmly untie his apron. "They should be getting here any moment," he said.
"They should what?"
Diana put her fork down. "Julian, what are you talking about?" Tavi was standing up on a wobbly chair, his face pressed to the window. He made an excited squeaking noise.
"Who are all those people coming up the road, Jules?"
Kit and Ty immediately jumped to their feet and scrambled for a window view.
"I see fairies," Ty said. "I think those are werewolves. Those black cars have to be vampires."
"And shadow hunters," said Kit. "So many shadow hunters."
"The sanctuary's almost ready," said Julian, throwing down a dish towel. "Unless someone else wants to do it, I'll go downstairs and greet our guests."
Jace stood up. Clary looked up at him in concern. His golden eyes were flat with anger.
"I'm not going to ask you a second time, Julian Blackthorne," he said in his usually amused voice had no amusement in it at all. "What did you do?"
Julian leaned his hip against the counter. Emma realized with a shock that, though he did look much younger, he was just as tall as Jace.
"Remember when you said my coalition idea was a bad one, because we couldn't trust other shadow hunters to be telling us the truth about their loyalties?"
"Vividly," said Jace.
"But I gather you invited everyone to a war council anyway?"
"They're here right now?" Clary sputtered. "But I'm wearing a t-shirt that says Unicorn Power."
"There are no such things as unicorns," Jace said.
"I know," Clary said. "That's why it's funny."
"To return to the issue of betrayal," Jace began.
"What if I told you I expected betrayal," said Julian. "In fact, that I was counting on it, that it was part of my plan."
"What plan?" said Jace.
"I always have a plan," said Julian calmly.
Drew lifted her coffee cup.
"It's great to have you back, Jules. I missed your lunatic schemes."
Helen was on her feet now. Aline appeared to be trying not to giggle.
"How did you invite them all here?" Helen said. "How would you even have gotten in touch with so many downworlders and Nephilim and so quickly?"
"I corresponded with them all for years," Julian said. "I was head of the Institute. I know how to send fire messages to warlocks and shadow hunters and acorn messages to fairy, and the telephone numbers of every important vamp and werewolf. I know how to reach the downworlder shadow hunter alliance. I had to know those things. For 5 years, it was my job."
"But didn't you usually write to them as Arthur before?" said Helen, clearly worried. "Who did you pretend to be this time?"
"I know these people. I know their personalities. I know which of them will be on our side. I've been head of the Institute here for years. I called on my allies because it's been my job to know who my allies are."
His voice was quiet but firm. There was nothing disrespectful in what he'd said, but Emma knew what he meant.
"I've been a diplomat for years now, unknown and unacknowledged, but that doesn't mean I wasn't skilled at it. I've put those skills to use, whether you like it or not. We can't fight the cohort alone, he said. They're part of us, part of our government. They're not an outside threat like Sebastian was. We need these allies. You'll see. And then he looked at Emma as if he couldn't help it. The message in his eyes was clear. Though she was reeling from the shock of what he'd done, he was hoping for her approval, as he always had. She felt a burning pulse through her parabatai rune. She winced, glanced down at her left arm. Her skin felt hot and tight, but the rune looked normal. It had just been a look, she thought, that was all. I'll help finish setting up the sanctuary for the meeting, she said. We'll need chairs. Kieran got to his feet, pushing sea-blue hair behind his ears. I will also help, he said. I thank you on behalf of my people for calling down worlders to the table as equals. You are right. None of us can do this alone. Diana stood up. I will send a message to Gwyn, she said. I know he will be pleased to come, and you will have the Wild Hunt on your side. It was Christina's turn to rise. Did you reach out to the Mexico City Institute? Yes, said Julian. Your mother said she'd be pleased to attend. Christina looked alarmed. I have to go change my clothes, she said, and fled. The younger Blackthorns watched with wide eyes as Jace held up his hand. Emma tensed. Jace was a powerful shadow hunter, not just physically, but politically. He and Clary could upset every facet of this plan if they wanted. Did you invite Magnus and Alec? He said. Do they know our plans have changed? Our plans. Emma began to relax. Of course, said Julian. I invited everyone I thought would be on our side, and I told everyone I invited they could reach out to others they trusted. This is probably a bad idea, Jace said. Like a record-breakingly bad idea, like a go-down-in-history bad idea, but... Clary bounced to her feet. What he means is, we're in, she said. We love bad ideas. That's true, Jace admitted, smile breaking over his face. Suddenly he looked 17 again. Aline was the last to rise. Technically, this is my institute, she said. We do what I say. She paused. And I do what Helen wants. What do you want, baby? Helen smiled. I want a war council, she said. Let's get ready. Chapter 27. Far and Free. They streamed in through the open doors of the sanctuary, one after another. Downworlders and shadow hunters in a seemingly never-ending cascade. First came the vampires, with their paper-white faces and cold elegance. Enchanted black umbrellas held aloft as they took the few steps from their tinted windowed cars to the sanctuary doors, eager to escape the sun. Emma recognized Lily Chen among them, on the arm of a tall vampire with dreadlocks. A gaggle of blonde Swedish vampires came in chatting with the Lindquists who ran the Stockholm Institute. There were werewolves from all over the world. Luke Garraway, scruffy and bearded in his flannel jacket. Clary's mother, Jocelyn, at his side. Werewolves in kilts and hanboks and cheapows. Maya Roberts and Bat Velasquez. Emma felt a pang thinking of the other version of them in Thule, still together, still hand in hand. There were warlocks, too, more than Emma had ever seen in one place. Katerina Loss, blue-skinned and white-haired. She marched in with Tessa and Jem, wearing nurse's scrubs and looking around her thoughtfully. Her eyes lit on Kit, and she gazed at him with a quiet recognition that he, absorbed in talking to Ty, didn't notice. Hypatia Vex, with her bronze hair and dark skin, regal and curious. Warlocks with bat's wings and hooves and gills and rainbow eyes, with delicate antenna and curving stag's horns. A bat-faced woman who went up to Christina and began muttering in Spanish. A dark-skinned warlock with a white mark on his cheek in the shape of a spider web. And there were shadow hunters. Emma had seen many shadow hunters gathered together before. She'd been to quite a few council meetings. But it was gratifying to see how many had answered Julian's call. He stood at the front of the room, where the Blackthorns and their friends had hastily assembled a long table. A rolled-up banner hung on the wall behind it.
Julian leaned calmly against the table, but Emma could sense the tension running through him like electrical lines as the shadow hunters began to file into the sanctuary. Julie Beauvail and Beatrice Mendoza, their Parabatai runes glimmering on their forearms. Marisol Garza, wearing white in memory of John Cartwright. Magnus and Alec had just arrived with Maris and their kids and were standing by the door opposite Aline and Helen, greeting the downworlders while the two women greeted the shadow hunters. Kadir Safar of the New York Conclave gave Diana a somber nod before going to speak with Maris, who was dandling little blue Max on her lap while Rafe ran around them both in circles. The Romeros had come from Argentina, the Pederosos from Brazil, the Kios from Cambodia, and the Rosewains from northern England. A dark-haired, petite woman who darted over to Christina and hugged her tightly. Christina's mom. She had an urge to bow in acknowledgement of the woman who had named Perfect Diego.
"It's cool to see the Alliance in action," said Mark, who had been helping the others set up rows of chairs. He had put on a somber dark suit jacket in an attempt to look more serious. Like the careful arrangement of the food at the meeting the other day, the small gesture made Emma's heart spark with tenderness. There were many ways to serve your family, she thought. Julian's way was in large and passionate gestures. Mark's were smaller and quieter, but meaningful just the same.
Alec seems to know every downworlder in the place. It was true. Alec was greeting a werewolf girl who spoke in excitable French and asked him something about Raphael. A tall, dark-haired vampire wearing a t-shirt with Chinese characters on it slapped him on the back, and Lily and Maya darted over to confer with him in low voices. Mark suddenly straightened up. Emma followed his gaze and saw that several fairies had come into the room. She laid her hand on Mark's arm, wondering if he remembered the last time he had been in the sanctuary, when the Wild Hunt had returned him to his family. Kieran had turned around. He had been behind the table, speaking with Julian in a low voice, and was staring as well. Gwyn had come in, of course, which everyone expected, but following him were several others. Among the dryads and pixies and nixies, Emma recognized several piskies, the fair folk she and Julian had encountered in Cornwall. Behind them came a tall pooka in a Justice for Kaylee t-shirt, and after him a woman in a long green cloak, her face hidden, but a bit of white blonde hair escaping, nonetheless. Emma turned to Mark.
It's Neen. I must speak with her.
Mark gave Emma's shoulder a pat and vanished across the room to greet his aunt. Emma caught sight of both Kieran and Christina watching him, though Christina had been firmly captured by her mother and clearly wasn't going anywhere. Emma glanced over at Julian again. He had moved behind the table and was standing with his arms at his sides. Helen and Aline had joined him behind the table as well. The rest of the family was clustered in a group of chairs at the left of the room, Kit and Ty together, Drew with her hand on Tavi's shoulder, turning around to squint at a figure who had just come into the sanctuary. It was Cameron. He was alone, slouched a little as if he had hoped no one would see him, though his bright red hair was like a beacon. Emma couldn't help herself. She darted over to him. He looked surprised as she bore down on him and caught his hands in hers.
Thank you for coming, Cameron, she said. Thank you for everything.
The rest of my family doesn't know, he said. They're pretty much...
On the cohort side, I know, said Emma.
But you're different. You're a good guy. I know that for sure now. And I'm sorry if I ever hurt you in the past.
Cameron looked even more alarmed.
I don't think we should get back together, he said.
Oh, definitely not, said Emma. I'm just glad you're okay.
She glanced over at Julian, who was waving and giving Cameron a thumbs up from behind the table. Looking terrified, Cameron bolted for the safety of the seats.
Someday, maybe she'd tell him about Thule. Maybe.
She waved to Simon and Isabel as they came in, holding hands. Isabel made an obedient beeline for her mother and Max. Simon regarded Kieran with a look of surprised recognition before crossing the room to talk to Vivian Penhollow, the dean of Shadowhunter Academy. Sometimes Emma wondered if Simon had enjoyed his time at the academy. She wondered if she would like it there. But there was no point in thinking about the future now.
She glanced over at Julian. The wide doors were still open and a breeze was passing through. And for a moment, Emma saw Livy. Not as she had been in Thule, but the Livy of this world. Like a vision or a hallucination, standing behind Julian, her hand on his shoulder, her ethereal hair rising in the wind. Emma closed her eyes, and when she opened them again, Julian was alone. As if he could feel her gaze, Julian glanced at Emma. He looked incredibly young to her for a moment, as if he were still the 12-year-old boy who had hiked a mile back and forth every week from the highway, dragging heavy bags to make sure his brothers and sisters had groceries. "If only you had told me," she thought. "If only I had known when you needed help." She couldn't be Julian's Parabatai or his partner now. She couldn't smile at him, as Clary smiled at Jace, or put a reassuring hand against his back the way Alec did to Magnus, or take his hand as Aline had taken Helen's. But she could be his ally. She could stand with the others at the front of the room and face the crowd, at least. She began to cross the room toward the table. Mark reached Neen at the same time Helen did. Their aunt seemed agitated, her long, pale fingers working at the emerald material of her cloak. Her eyes darted between them as they approached, and she gave a small, stiff nod.
"Miok," she said.
"Alessa, it is good to see you well."
"Aunt Neen," Helen said, "it's good of you to come, and is everything all right?"
"I was ordered to remain at court after the Queen returned from Unseelie," said Neen. "She has been furious and untrusting since that time. For me to be here, I disobeyed a direct order of my monarch's." She sighed. "It is possible I can never return to the court."
"Neen," Helen looked horrified. "You didn't have to come."
"I wished to," Neen said. "I have lived in fear of the Queen all my life. I have lived in fear of what I wished for, to depart the court and live as one of the wild fae. But you, my niece and nephew, you live between worlds, and you are not afraid." She smiled at them, and Mark wanted to point out that he was afraid half the time. He didn't.
"I will do what I can to help you here," she said. "Your cause is righteous. It is time for the cold peace to come to an end."
Mark, who hadn't realized Julian had been promising an end to the cold peace, made a slight choking noise.
"Adean," he said. "I know Helen wrote to you of him. He saved our lives. I wish to bring you the news myself."
"Adean is well," said Neen. "He has become something of a favorite of the Seelie Queen, and has risen quickly in the court." Mark blinked. He hadn't been expecting this. "A favorite of the Seelie Queen?" "I think Mark wants to know if he's the Seelie Queen's lover," said Helen, with her usual bluntness.
"Oh, most likely.
It is quite surprising," said Neen. "Fergus is much put out, as he was the favorite once."
"Greetings, Neen," said Kieran, striding up to them. He had changed out of his jeans and looked every bit the fairy prince, as Mark had first seen him, in creamy linen and fawn breeches. His hair was a dark night ocean blue.
"It is good to see you as well.
How is Adean, my brother? Not too much under the thumb of the Queen?"
"Only if he wants to be," said Neen, cheerfully.
Kieran looked puzzled. Mark put his face in his hands.
"Emma!"
Halfway to the table, Emma turned and found Jem approaching her, a shy smile on his face. She had seen him come in earlier with Tessa, who was now seated beside Katerina Loss. She blinked at him as he reached her. It felt like centuries since she'd seen him, the awful day of Livy's funeral.
"Emma," Jem took her hands in his. "Are you all right?" "He sees how tired I look," she thought. "My puffy eyes, rumpled clothes, who knows what else."
She tried to smile.
"I'm really glad to see you, Jem."
The light from the chandelier illuminated the scars on his cheekbones.
"That's not really an answer to my question," he said.
"Tessa told me about Thule. You have been on quite a journey." "I guess we all have," she said in a low voice. "It was awful, but we're back now."
He squeezed her hands and released them.
I wanted to thank you, he said, for all the help you and your friends have rendered us in curing the warlock illness.
You have been a better friend to me than I have been to you, Maymay.
No, you've helped me so many times, Emma protested.
She hesitated.
Actually, there's a question I wanted to ask you.
Jem put his hands in his pockets.
Of course. What is it?
Do you know how to strip a shadow hunter's marks? Emma said. Jem looked stunned.
What?
He glanced around the room as if to make sure no one was looking at them. Most people had taken their seats and were thankfully looking toward the front of the room expectantly.
Emma, why would you ask me about something so awful?
She thought quickly.
Well, the cohort. Maybe the way to remove them from power is not to hurt them, but to make them not shadow hunters anymore. And you were a silent brother, so could you do it, or...
Her voice trailed off at the horrified look on his face.
Emma, not every decision rests on your shoulders. The Clave will be restored, and they will deal with the cohort.
Jem's voice gentled.
I know you are worried, but as a silent brother, I have been part of the ceremony of stripping the marks from a shadow hunter before. It is something so horrible, I would never repeat it. I would never do it. Not under any circumstances.
Emma felt as if she were choking.
Of course. I'm sorry I brought it up.
It's all right. There was so much understanding in his voice it broke her heart.
I know you were afraid, Emma. We all are.
She looked after him as he walked away. Despair was making it hard for her to breathe.
I am afraid, she thought. But not of the cohort. Of myself.
Emma took her place behind the table at the front of the room. Mark had also joined the small group, and she stood beside him, some distance from Julian. The doors had been closed and the torches lit, and row after row of faces stared back at them from the lines of chairs set up in the middle of the room. They had run out of chairs, in fact, and quite a few downworlders and shadow hunters were leaning against the walls, watching. Thank you for responding to my summons, Julian said. Emma could feel his nerves, his tension, speeding the pace of her own blood through her veins. But he showed none of it. There was an easy command in his voice, the room falling silent as he spoke without him needing to shout. I won't drag out any explanations or introductions. You know who I am. You know my sister and brother. You know Aline Penhallow and Emma Carstairs. You know that Aline's mother, our consul, has been illegally taken into custody. You know that Horace Dearborn has seized power in Idris.
He was voted in, said Kwasi Bediako, the warlock Emma had noticed before with the white spider mark on his face.
Christina had whispered to her that Bediako was the High Warlock of Accra.
We cannot pretend otherwise.
No one voted for him to throw my mother in jail, said Aline. No one voted for him to remove the consul from power so he could be in charge.
There are others in jail as well,
said Christina's mother. Christina, sitting beside her, turned bright red.
Diego Rocio Rosales has been jailed, for nothing.
Kieran glanced back at her, a small smile at the corner of his mouth.
As has my cousin Divya,
said Anoush Joshi, a young man with a jagged black haircut and an anxious face.
What do you plan to do about it? Intercede with the council?
Julian glanced briefly down at his hands, as if gathering himself.
Everyone, all of us here, have always accepted a certain amount of prejudice from the Clave as normal, through choice or necessity.
The room was quiet, no one disagreed, but there were many eyes cast down, as if in shame.
Now the cohort has changed what we thought of as normal, Julian said. Never before have downworlders been driven from Idris. Never before have shadow hunters jailed other shadow hunters without even the pretense of a trial.
Why do we care what shadow hunters do to each other?
Demanded the Pooka in the Kaylee t-shirt.
Because that's step one. And what they do to downworlders will be worse, Emma said, surprising herself.
She hadn't meant to speak, only to stand by Julian.
They've already registered many of you.
So you're saying we need to fight them, said Gwyn in his rumbling voice. This is a call to arms.
Julie Beauvale rose to her feet.
They may not be a good clave, but they are still shadow hunters. There are a lot of people who follow the cohort who are scared. I don't want to hurt those people, and their fear is real, especially now that Jace and Clary are dead. They were our heroes, and I knew them.
Julie, Beatrice hissed, sit down.
Jace and I were personally very close, Julie went on. I wouldn't hesitate to call them my best friends, and I...
Julie!
Beatrice took Julie by the tail of her shirt and hauled her back into her seat. She cleared her throat.
I think that what Julie meant is that you're saying the cohort wants to destroy the government. I'm guessing, given all the secrecy, that you also want to destroy the government, and I don't know how we do that without hurting innocent people.
There was a hum of conversation. In the shadows, Emma saw them. She didn't know when they'd come in, but a single Iron Sister and a single Silent Brother stood motionless against the far wall, their faces in shadow. A slight chill went through her. She knew the Iron Sisters were against the cohort. She didn't know about the Silent Brothers. They both seemed like emissaries of the law, standing there in their silence.
We're not suggesting destroying the government, Julian said. We're saying it's being destroyed right now, already, from within. The Clave was built to give all Shadowhunters a voice. If we are all voiceless, then it is not our government. The law was enacted to protect us, and to allow us to protect others. When laws are bent and broken to put the innocent in danger, then it is not our law. Valentine wanted to rule the Clave. Sebastian wanted to burn it down. We only want to return our rightful consul to power and to allow the government of Shadowhunters to be what it should be. Not a tyranny, but a representation of who we are and what we want.
Those are some pretty words, said the French werewolf who'd been talking to Alec earlier. But Jace and Clary were beloved of your people. They will want a war against those who harmed them.
Yes, said Julian. I'm counting on that.
There was no gesture, no signal that Emma could see, but the doors of the sanctuary opened, and Jason Clary walked in as if on cue. At first there was no reaction from the crowd. The light from the torches was bright, and neither of the two were in gear. Jace wore jeans, and Clary a plain blue dress. As they passed through the crowd, people blinked at them until finally Lily Chen, looking annoyed, stood up and said in a loud, bored voice,
I cannot believe my own eyes. Isn't that Jace Herondale and Clary Fairchild back from the dead?
The reaction that ripped through the crowd was electric. Clary looked over with some alarm as the roar grew. Jace just smirked as the two of them joined Emma and the others behind the long table. Lily had resumed her seat and was examining her nails. Julian was calling for people to be quiet, but his voice was drowned out by the noise. Feeling that this was an area in which she could excel, Emma jumped up onto the table and shouted,
Everyone! She yelled. Everyone, shut up!
The decibel level fell immediately. Emma could see Christina giggling, her hand over her mouth. Beside her, Jace shot finger guns at Julie Beauvale, who had turned bright pink.
Good to see you, bestie, he said.
Simon's shoulders were shaking. Isabel, who had been watching with a half-smile, patted his back. Clary scrunched her nose at Jason and turned to the crowd.
Thank you, she said, her voice low but carrying. We're glad to be here.
The room fell pin-drop silent. Emma jumped down from the table. Julian was surveying the assembly.